The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Monday, October 23rd, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I watch the Sunday shows. That's what I do for you, my Gist friends. Actually, it's a little untrue. I don't watch them, and I don't always consume them on Sundays. I listen at double speed. Got all the networks, got the Tapper, got Fox News Sunday, which is on Fox News on Sundays. I take the hit, but I also take the notes. I get overjoyed when I hear the same talking point repeated on two or three shows. Here on Face the Nation, Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney made an argument for not allowing federal taxpayers to deduct state and local taxes.
If you live in New York and I live in South Carolina, I actually pay more in federal tax than you do, and that's not fair.
Same talking point shows up on Fox News Sunday, but with a different state. In this case, he doesn't refer to South Carolina, which actually does have state taxes. He chooses a state without state taxes.
One of the things we're driving at is fairness. And if you live in Wyoming and I live in New York and we make the same amount of money, our house is worth the same amount of money, our cars are worth the same amount of money, all other things being equal, shouldn't we pay the same amount of federal tax? I think it's yes. The president thinks it's yes. Secretary Mnuchin thinks it's yes. Most people think that we should pay the same amount. That's not the way our tax system works right now. Right now, if you live in Wyoming, all other things being equal, you pay more tax than someone who lives in New York. That's just not fair.
Now, Mulvaney isn't lying. He's making an argument. It's just that the word federal is doing a lot of work in that argument. Would a fair-minded taxpayer in New York, talking to his fair-minded tax-paying brethren in Alaska, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, Wyoming, I just named all the states without state taxes, would he say, you know, brother, I'm getting one over on you. I could deduct my local taxes of $5,000 on my federal form. That is a savings, if you look at my bracket, of $1,500. Might not his wise South Dakotan fellow taxpayer say, are you an idiot? You just told me you pay $5,000 in state taxes. Sure, you get to deduct it on federal taxes, but overall, you're paying a lot more taxes. Anyway, the state and local deduction is freaking sacrosanct. It ain't going anywhere. But when I was listening to Fox News Sunday this week, guest hosted by Dana Perino, I heard her introduce a segment using music that I thought was sacrosanct. Listen to this music underneath the intro to Sarah Huckabee.
Plus, so I was the first Republican woman press secretary. You are the second, but you are the first working mother.
Sarah Sanders on balancing life at home and at the White House. All right now on Fox News Sunday.
And hello again from Fox News in Washington.
I don't know why, but I was having this almost Pavlovian response. I said to myself, soon an Englishman will address me. I don't know why I said that, except that I figured it out. Here's why.
This is the BBC. The details of our complete...
That is the music for the BBC Global News podcast. Let us hear the Fox News Sunday thing.
Plus, so I was the first Republican woman press secretary. You are the second.
And again, the BBC thing. It's the same thing, right? I don't know if Fox is stealing from the BBC or just borrowing music that everyone can find the rights to. But I am here to alert the world that Fox listens to the BBC and they like what they're hearing. Someone at Fox News said, hey, here's a sound that sounds newsy, that ain't fake news. In fact, we're going to put it on our broadcast. Fox stands by what the BBC is broadcasting. On the show today, I spiel about another Fox interview with another member of the Trump administration. In fact, the guy who branded the Trump administration, Trump, it's Trump. But first, they say you can't take it with you, and that is true at all-you-can-eat buffets in the petting zoo. But life also, that's what they usually say it about. And when you're gone, they will remember you at your funeral. But how will you know what they said? Tom Sawyer staged his own funeral. Today's Tom Sawyer is audio journalist Kathleen Horan, who's been reporting on the dead and the not-yet-dead, which is to say all of us here on Earth, who spend countless hours plotting on stealing a llama from a petting zoo.
This is Jess Betancourt, the host of DNA ID, the only true crime podcast that exclusively covers cases solved using forensic genealogy. DNA ID goes behind the headlines to answer your questions about this remarkable new crime-solving tool, how it works, how cases are selected, why the cases were unsolved for so long, and how the justice system is addressing it. I include input from law enforcement to give you the inside scoop that we all crave with a straightforward, no-nonsense delivery. You can find DNA ID on any podcast platform. Episodes come out weekly on Mondays.
When you die, how do you want to be remembered? I would like to be recalled fondly as a good father, a boon companion, a nice co-worker, and a qualified lessee. How do you want to be remembered? This is an unstated premise of the new, not a podcast, but Audible original series, Mortal City. Mortal City is, in fact, an Audible original series available for free. And the woman behind all this, these little bits of genius, is Kathleen Horan, who I've known for a long time. Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Mike.
When you were at WNYC, you had an interesting beat. You just did obituaries for everyone who died? Everyone you could?
I did a lot of endings.
Yeah.
For mostly people, some places, some places that were closing.
Mm-hmm.
It makes for a great story, a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Right.
So whether it was, you know, Luther Vandross's funeral at the Riverside Church where some woman waiting in line that wasn't going to get into the church, I asked her why she was still waiting, and she said, I conceived my son to a Luther song. Or some man named Whitey that hung out in Park Slope who was homeless, but he used to sweep the streets and the neighbors got together and buried him and had a memorial service for him. There's just so many great stories.
First, I want to amend my how I want to be remembered answer, and that Luther Vandross funeral, that sounds good. I'll take that too. But so this series, Mortal City, is not about dead people. It's about the pre-dead in a way. It's about looking at the lives of people, maybe the sort of people who you would do a story about, and kind of doing a profile, but as if it were an obit. Am I pretty much getting that right?
Well, it's a pre-obituary with the knowledge that we're here temporarily.
Mm-hmm.
So why not meet memorable people while they're still here? After doing that beat for a while, I just kept feeling like there was people that I was missing. And those people were not famous. They were people that were here and that were not self-selecting on social media. These aren't the people that are going to tap you on the shoulder and say, do I have a story for you?
Yeah.
And that's why I'm sort of obsessed with them, because they're sitting on a great, great tale, but they need you to ask them to tell them.
How does an obituary differ from a profile? It's a profile, story of a person who's living.
An obituary has an ending.
Mm-hmm. But these stories in Mortal City don't have an ending. You don't predict how they're going to die.
No, but there is the weight of time. And a profile doesn't have as much the weight of time. I love that every magazine profile starts meeting them in a cafe and what they're going to order.
Yeah, she tucked into her green salad. Like, that won't be in an obit.
Yeah.
Freshly scrubbed and wearing capris.
Oh, her
not
skin.
In an obit.
Oh, yeah. So you can't believe her skin. I mean, every article. So there's not a lot of that.
She demurely orders the cob, but asks for the egg on the side. That's how she will be remembered.
And then also, there are these details that, whether you like them or not, are going to appear in your obituary,
mm-hmm.
especially if you're a little bit well-known. So there's the stuff that you want to be in there, that you work hard for people to see you in this way. And then there's the stuff that you just have, you can't really do anything about. It just is you.
So when you do one of these profiles on Mortal City, one of these pre-obituaries, and they're not of famous people, you don't really want to do necessarily warts and all in a way that would offend them, that you might do, especially if we were a famous person who has died. But then how do you get at the stuff that's not just celebratory hagiography, et cetera? Stuff that fleshes out the person more than even the person's own kind of self-promotion would lead you to.
They just can't help themselves but show you higher up on the thigh of their story. I think that they're just so used to not living, you know, in ways that people expect them, that they just don't care anymore. They're not asking for any permission slips to be signed. They're not asking for you to accept them. You know, a sex worker for 20 years or a sanitation worker, drag performer. These are people that aren't exactly marching in step with other people. So they're freer to tell you some of the bits that you might not normally talk about at dinner.
So one of those people was Rocky. Who was Rocky?
Rocky, who isn't Rocky?
Yeah.
he has done just about every job. One of my favorite things is just every time I saw him, he would tell me like three or four other jobs that he did.
I like to be the best of everything, you know what I'm saying?
Over the years, he says he's driven a taxi.
Then I had a job as a nightclub owner.
Owned a record shop.
Then I had a job as a DJ.
Ran a craps parlor.
And a lesbian club.
Cut hair.
When the Afro came out, I was the Afro King, you know. And then I was working in the garment center.
He says he's guarded JFK's tomb as a military police officer.
Jacqueline never visited during the day. She used to come at night. She used to have John Jr. in her arm. And Caroline in her little coat, and I used to be walking the eternal flame.
He was a pimp for a while.
Sure.
He robbed drug dealers.
Pimping. Yeah.
He also became an EMT after he saw his niece die in the streets and he couldn't help her. But then in Bedford-Stuyvesant, you know, emergency vehicles, especially ambulances, weren't getting there as fast as they were getting to other places. He calls it the hood. It used to be more of the hood at the time. And so he started a volunteer ambulance corps, and he trained all of the people out there that weren't getting jobs, that were maybe former drug addicts, that were ex-cons, that were people that maybe weren't pillars of society. He trained them and gave them a uniform, and they have been operating this volunteer ambulance corps, the Bed-Stuy Volleys, for about 30 years now.
Yeah, it's like, what a life. You don't know if you'd ever read about it or hear about it unless someone like you brought it to our attention. So how was it brought to your attention? How'd you meet the guy?
I was a reporter in the newsroom at WNYC, and I was doing one of those routine phone interviews on ambulance response times. And so I called Rocky Robinson because he had been a longtime EMT with the city and then, you know, operated this ambulance corps. So, of course, we talked about ambulance response times for like all of 3 minutes. And then I was in the studio with him taping for about an hour because everything he said was more fabulous than the next thing that he said. You know, this is a guy that only wears red undergarments. He's had 19 biological children that he knows of.
Sure.
He claims to be one of the originators of rap, and I believe him.
Mm-hmm.
I say in the show, this is someone I can't believe exists.
Yes.
And it sounds kind of gosh, shucks, but these people are actually people that you know, I really can't believe exists.
He claims to have invented the semicolon. It's impossible to check. How'd you meet Serge?
Serge, well, I'm a regular at Raoul's on Prince Street.
I did it seven times in one night.
You did the sexual act.
Yes.
From beginning to end, seven times.
Right.
It was a really long night.
Good, yeah.
Daylight savings time.
Raoul's is one of my favorite restaurants. Named after its owner, Serge Raoul. The place smells like musky perfume layered over seared meat.
You know, there's so many places in New York City now where you go and everyone has the special haircut. Everyone has the green juice. And Raoul's has always been this place where there's a lot of different kinds of people. You know, there's the grumpy guy with the New Yorker that gives you half a look and then goes back to his magazine. And then, you know, the fashion designer and the hedge fund guy. They're all mixing at the bar. So the more I would go there, the more I heard little bits and pieces of these stories. And Serge is just one of those people that is incredibly memorable, not only because he found the place in 1975 and there was all of these, you know, basically feral cats living in the restaurant. The bathroom was in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a little bit of a health department no-no. They have
But they didn't really have letter grades.
Exactly.
They had wink and nod. That's all they had. Have you found out that any of your characters know each other?
I think the sanitation worker, Douglas, knows Rocky because Douglas was a sanitation worker in the neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Do you start a conversation and then say, let me arrange another time where I can record you? Or do you travel with your kit, as they say, and start micing people up right then and there?
I often travel with my kit, but you know, you don't want to be a nuisance. Mm-hmm. I'm just under a nuisance, you know.
However you define the line of nuisance, right,
I'm just
below
like
it.
Just a little. No, it's good to have a first meeting. It's good to have a first date.
Will you mostly start by asking them to relay an anecdote or asking them a question about their personality?
It depends on the time. I mean, I met Douglas on the subway,
yeah,
and I started hearing a little bit about him being a sanitation worker, and I always wanted to really get to know a sanitation worker.
Who doesn't? That was part of their program in the 70s. It was like guns buyback and get to know a sanitation worker.
Well, you know, have you noticed that they're the least likely to brag of the uniform city workers?
Yes.
But they've seen so much.
Well, all the other ones. So the cop, there's the New York's bravest. New York's in the prisons, it's the boldest. New York's finest. What are the sanitation? They have a thing.
Strongest, maybe?
Strongest. But strong but silent type.
Strong
also,
but silent.
Also, they show up at like 4 a.m.
There's something that I didn't include in the story, but one of the reasons that I wanted to interview a sanitation worker, there were many, was that in my neighborhood, I had heard about the sanitation worker. There was this woman, guess this, you know, these guys are on their routes for decades, usually. They're on the same route. And this woman lost her husband, and she was upset sitting outside of her apartment. And this guy waved the sanitation truck on, and he sat with her. I was really kind of touched by that. So there's just a lot going on with sanitation workers. I mean, not to mention this Douglas cleaned up New York back when there was 2,000 murders.
Yeah.
So he saw
feet and stuff in the trash.
He found more than 5 dead bodies.
Yeah.
Whole and in pieces.
Yeah. I feel, so when I examine myself, first of all, I have said that I would watch a YouTube channel of great obituaries. Like, I would love that, of great eulogies and great obituaries. There's really no better and more honest speech, type of speech. People really usually bring it in a good way about a person when they do a eulogy. And sometimes, I would say with most people, they've never had that sort of speech of praise about themselves. And I guess they don't afterwards. But I love a good eulogy.
You and me both.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have heard some amazing ones. I love a funny funeral.
Yeah.
You know, of course, there's going to be sadness. Of course, there's going to be grief. But to stick a little funny in the sad is where the magic comes in.
Yeah.
And I went to Norman Mailer's. I covered Norman Mailer's funeral. And I interviewed the waiter that waited on him for 30 years. He was this kind of sheepish looking guy. And then as soon as I went up to him and asked him how he knew Norman, he had really, and of course, he was a pretty good tipper.
Yeah.
You're not going to get a waiter to go to your funeral no. unless you share.
Strict 15% with double the tax and round down. That guy is not showing up at your funeral. Yeah, a good eulogy, when you say the funny mix with the sad, it's like why the class clown is an institution, because we're so irreverent in life, and this is a place or a setting where reverence is imposed upon that. And then if you could break from that at all, it's so satisfying, but it's also so human. I mean, it reflects more the human experience than anything else.
Yeah, and if you're trying to distill someone into their most essential potion,
yeah,
you know, you want to huff it real deep.
Yeah.
So you've got to get all of the bits. You've got to get all of the recipe of that person. So yes, their difficulty and their eccentricities, all of the ways that they were annoying. Then when you include the other more lovable bits, they're even more endearing.
Kathleen Horan is the creator and the proprietress, if you will, of Mortal City, which is an Audible original series available for free on audible.com. Go to originals if you get Audible, which like almost everyone does these days, or a member of Amazon Prime, you get this and you can listen to Mortal City. Thank you, Miss Horan.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel. Yesterday and today, President Donald J. Trump sat down with the Fox Business Channel's Maria Bartiromo. The two have done many interviews over the years. It is clear that Trump likes Bartiromo. She is respectful. She frequently prefaces a question by acknowledging that he has a complex plan in place. She just likes some details. The last time they talked, Trump made reference to his bombing Iraq. She quickly chimed in Syria, and he said, oh, yeah, Syria. This time, she gave him affirmation when necessary.
I am very happy with the way I've done prior to this in my civilian life, all right?
This is not about
other
you.
People.
And Bartiromo showed she had sympathy for the kind of abuse that Trump and those of his ilk have had to endure.
Because I feel like the Republicans get bullied by the left by this whole talking point of it's always tax cuts for the rich.
Yeah.
You've been traveling.
By the way, that's an automatic talking point.
Exactly.
I don't bring any of this up in the service of vetting or truth squatting Trump's interview or even doing an analysis of Bartiromo's interviewing style. What we see, what we more importantly hear in this interview, is that every time Trump talks without a script, it goes south. This interview, and I could have picked any interview, exemplify what a poor communicator he is. He has no chance of ever getting through to anybody who doesn't agree with him already. And I was thinking of Trump's communication style in the context of the conversation he had with the family of LaDavid Johnson, one of the soldiers killed in Niger. Trump said he expressed condolences. Rep. Frederica Wilson, Johnson's mother, and today on Good Morning America, Johnson's widow, say Trump was insensitive.
What he said was...
The president.
Yes, the president said that he knew what he signed up for, but it hurts anyways.
Now, in assessing who said what, none of us can know what was said or what was heard, and that could be two different things, but I just want to make a point about Trump's speech. Normally, he's speaking to an audience who so badly wants to hear what they perceive his message to be that they will fill in the gaps for him. They'll allow for his odd syntax. I would guess they don't even hear his odd syntax. They'll excuse his errors. They'll brush off his stumbles. Trump has created a situation where the only audience he cares to communicate to are listening through the ears of enablers. But just take his actual speech. I'm not going to play a glaring lie or a threat or a profanity. He makes those, some of them even in this interview. I'm just going to play the answer to Bartiromo's very first question.
Tell us where we stand on the tax plan right now.
We're doing very well. We will. We had a fantastic vote, as you know, and our budget is indirectly passed.
A fantastic vote. Well, I guess that means that the budget passed the Senate. The budget indirectly passed? What is that? I have no idea what that means. Has good prospects in the House? Is that what he's getting at? He continues.
Now it's going to go through a little bit of an iteration, but it's going to end up, I think, again, doing very well. And I think we're going to get our taxes. I think it's going to be, well, hopefully before the end of the year, but maybe much sooner than that. You know?
Stop and start sentences saying much sooner than before the end of the year. That's still the end of the year. And when he says we're going to get our taxes, I guess he means we're going to get our tax plan or you're going to get lower taxes, but we're going to get our taxes. And to circle back, as Trump does, when he says the end of the year prediction, does that apply to the budget? Does that apply to the tax plan? I think it applies to the tax plan because in other places, more articulate spokesmen have said so, but here it could just sound like the budget. And the budget doing very well. What does it mean that the budget is doing very well? Like we've budgeted for important things? I don't think that's what he means. Does he mean that it passed one of the houses and we think it's going to pass another house? It's so miasmic. You get that he's positive on the prospects and you get that budget is the noun. He's talking about the noun and there's hope, but there's some uncertainty. But what is this guy really saying? It would be nice if we were able to answer the question by listening to that which the guy says. That is not the case. He continues, same answer.
There's a great spirit for it. People want to see it. And I call it tax cuts. It is tax reform also, but I call it tax cuts. It'll be the biggest cuts ever in the history of this country. And I think that there's tremendous appetite, there's tremendous spirit for it, not only by the people we're dealing with in Congress, but for the people out there that want to see something. $5,000, almost, it can be $5,000 average per individual, per group.
I call it tax cuts because it is tax cuts. And this $5,000 question, $5,000, almost, it can be $5,000 per individual, per group. Which one? You just change the terms. All right. Here we do have to get into a little, I guess, fact checking. Per group, I guess, what, the VFW? All right. Here's what was going on. A sympathetic group came out and said the average American family would get a wage increase of $4,000 per family if his corporate tax plan was enacted. Let us not discuss the legitimacy of that claim. If Trump wanted to say something cogent along these lines, he'd say, you know, the average American family are going to see their wages rise $4,000 a year because of my tax plan. So $4,000 in the pockets of hardworking Americans. I'm not even asking that he clarifies, oh, this is part of my corporate tax reduction. It sounds like he's just saying your tax bill is going to be almost $5,000 less. That's not actually what he's even trying to say. But what is he knows he's exaggerating. So he hems and haws, 5,000 almost can be. And then he realizes, wait a minute, that number, even though it's not 5,000, it was really meant for families. So he said people, but not individual. And he goes per group. By the way, this wasn't his worst answer. This was just his first answer. The second answer was just as much a mushmouth pile of ace and tactical garbage.
I think that other people, you know, we had tremendous enthusiasm this time. Healthcare, I was told, was tougher, but it was close. I mean, so far, I would say it's not even a contest.
I think other people, then that thought's abandoned. We had tremendous enthusiasm. Had? Don't you mean have? Like this is an ongoing process. I think he means that the Republicans are more united on tax cuts than they were healthcare. Putting aside whether this is true or not, it seems like it could be true. Healthcare, I was told it was closer, like closer to achieving. He probably means that he always knew that the healthcare vote would be contentious. I was told it was closer. But of course, you don't have to be told it was closer. The results were a failing vote. So maybe a more understandable way of expressing this sentiment would be, I always knew the healthcare vote would be more contentious than I expect tax cuts to be. That is him translated into competent speak. And then when he goes, it's not even a contest. No, it's not a contest. It's two different pieces of legislation, one of which failed. Now, I hope someone hearing my analysis is saying to themselves, I'm being unfair. I hope you're saying, come on, Mike, it's not as bad as you make out. You know what he means. Only a Trump hater can't figure out what he's trying to say. Yeah, this is said of Trump all the time. Maybe it's true. But think about what those statements add up to, what he means, what he's trying to say. So when Trump is talking to the family of LaDavid Johnson, he's speaking to a mother who is a non-college educated black woman. Trump won 3% of the vote of non-college educated black women. I don't know about the widow, Maisha Johnson's educational attainment, but even if she went to college, he got 6% of the vote of college educated black women. I bring it up for one reason. It's only to point out that it is a demographic probability that the Johnsons were not already Trump backers as they sat in the limo with Rep. Frederica Wilson. I think we could say, or it's safe to assume, they were not Trump backers to believe in. And this is not the case with most military families. Active duty military voted overwhelmingly for Trump, 2-1. Troops who said they were looking forward to a career in the military, 3-1. And the other soldiers who died in Niger, who we're not hearing from, they were all white men in that category. I am not guessing what the actual political leanings of the grieving families were. And it's really quite possible that throw politics out the window, you just want to connect to someone as a person. I'm just noting what the dynamic of the Johnson family probably was. There was a vociferous Trump opponent right there in the car with them. It's just a very different audience than Trump has ever really cared about trying to talk to. In this case, he was playing far outside his base and it did not play. So am I saying, look, there was probably miscommunication on all sides? Well, yeah, but even if I'm saying that, isn't it on the attempted consoler? Isn't most of the burden on the person, the president, trying to offer condolences? What would be the harshest thing you could say about the Johnsons? They didn't receive the condolences properly. I guess it's possible they were deaf to anything he said, or so worked up with rage they really couldn't hear him, or that his words were kind and reassuring, but when it went from the cochlear center of the ear to the auditory context, those soothing words were twisted into something they weren't. But it's much more likely that Trump has just done zero communication with people who aren't already on board, who don't make up in their minds, who don't make up for his deficiencies, people who rely on exact phrases and normal sentence structure and words sticking more or less to their common definitions to understand what the speaker is talking about. Trump has never attempted to speak to or to legislate for people who aren't already in his camp. And this is a consequence of that. Trump has divided the country into us and them, and he elicits and solicits cheers from the us and seeks to vilify the them. That is his strategy. Trump is energized by conflict and relies on his version of us to be energized as well. The words he spoke to the widow and mother of LaDavid Johnson are an example of his inability to speak to the them. And it hurts so much because LaDavid Johnson died fighting for all of us. And that's it for today's show. Just producer Dan Schrader is working on a mashup between American Horror Story Season 3's theme and the Teletubbies. Mary Wilson, Just producer, is done with DJ-invented mashups, and she's more into DIY mashups. So what you do is you get two different earbuds attached to two different iPods and manually alternate ears. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, enjoyed that mashup of the Tom Petty song and the Sam Smith song, or as he thinks of it, that Tom Petty song. The Gist. Mashups. Isn't that kind of impossible? Just by the state of matter and the actual hand motion involved, aren't they all mashdowns? Park in a driveway, drive in a parkway. Oom-paroo-da-paroo-doo-paroo. Thanks for listening.